so much for joining Hashtag No Limits. I am your host, Shelley Kino. And Hashtag No Limits is about people who society places limits upon, but who are busting through those limits. Ophelia says in Hamlet, we know who we are, but not who we will be. And I believe that to be 100% true, and that there is not a better or more beautiful example than the caterpillar turning into the butterfly. I just want to give you the science lesson, a very brief and very simple version of the science of how that happens. The caterpillar literally dissolves into its cells, and just when it must think its life is over, it is reformed into the butterfly, but it's not finished struggling. It then has to struggle in order for its wings to be able to be strong enough to take it everywhere that it will go once it's out of that cocoon. And I just think that's such a beautiful example of each of us. And while butterflies only go through that once, I think we as humans go through that multiple times throughout our life. And I'm really excited to share my guest with you today. And we're going to bring him on in just a minute. But of course, I have to go through the technical stuff of, hey, remember to like and subscribe and set that notification bell so that you don't miss an episode and learn all the wonderful things that all my amazing guests are doing. And if you're watching in the replay, give us a hashtag replay and where you're from. And if you're watching live, give us a hashtag live and where you're watching from. So to my guest today, his name is Alan Stevens, and it has been said about Alan, and I want to get this right, so I am looking on my form to make sure that I say it exactly right. It was quoted recently that Freud diagnosed, Jung explored, Adler empowered, but Alan Stevens delivers. Welcome, Alan. Thank you so much for being my guest today. How are you doing?
Pretty good, Shelley, and thanks very much for the invitation.
Yes, I'm so excited.
Yeah, well, I love the analogy you gave with the butterfly before, the caterpillar, because that's what I look at with the children, and that's what we can do with them, help them to go from the caterpillar into the butterfly. But it's the way in which we do it.
Yes, absolutely. And that's why I say, you know, I know it only happens once in a caterpillar's life, but I do really think that it happens multiple times. And I think at any given moment, any one of us is the caterpillar, and we just don't know what's going to happen in our next breath, the next day, next year. And so I just always think having that in mind has helped me as a teacher when I was in the classroom, in the traditional classroom, and remembering that most of those students in my classroom were still at the caterpillar stage. They had a lot to go before they were going to become that butterfly, but that didn't mean they wouldn't become the butterfly.
That's right. Now, it all comes down to how we act, what we do. This is the thing that I know that a lot of parents are trying to turn their children into something. You know, there's an old saying that we're not sculptors and we're not carpenters. Our job is not to turn our children into something. We are gardeners. Our job is to nurture them so that they become the best version of themselves. And by doing that, we've got a much better chance of helping them to go from that caterpillar stage to that butterfly. And every child, no matter who they are, has that ability. And that's what I love about it. So it comes back to the way we work with them, not that we expect them to do, but how we then connect with them that we get those results.
Yes. And I love that you said the best version of themselves, because I think that's our job. Absolutely. As parents, as educators, is not to, and the reason this is called hashtag no limits is because a lot of people, and I was, and I still find myself having limiting beliefs about different people, different opportunities. And then I'm so glad when those get busted and I go, wow, I never thought about it like that before. But that's what it is. It's a thinking pattern that so many people have of, oh, well, this person is this, and this is all they're ever going to be. When if we say, you know what, this person is this, but let's see if, you know, maybe if they get the right supports, if they get the right encouragement, if they get whatever it is, they can be here.
That's it. Quite often we put limitations on people. These are our expectations. But if we didn't do that, if we looked for and understood where their real gifts are, and by the way, there isn't a child on this planet, there isn't a person on this planet who doesn't have a gift in one area or another. And that gift will be uniquely different to everybody else. So I don't care what they say about all the different psychometric profiling where they put people in boxes. You've got a whole bunch of people who are classed as this. Well, I come along and I like to take people out of the box and treat them as individuals. because every one of them, different life, even twins that were grown up all their life, being virtually almost connected at the hips, have got differences. So we might start off with very similar, but as we go up, different experience, we have different, if one child's looking in one direction, the other one's looking in the other direction, they're taking in different things and they're going to start to change in their personalities. So the fact that everybody's different, and we go, okay, well, I don't look at where the faults are in a person, I look for where's their gift, and if I can help them nurture that, we're always going to get great results and they will go well beyond our expectations.
Yes, absolutely. I wish I had like the explosion happy emoji right now, because I am like, oh my gosh, you are speaking words that I have spoken. And I've said this exact, I mean, almost verbatim to what you were saying about even twins are their own individual person. And we cannot expect the same thing from every person. We cannot discipline the same person in exactly the same way and expect the exact result. We cannot encourage each person the same way and expect the exact results. And so that was, I was sitting here thinking, did he like find my presentations for my teachings and my professional developments online? And he's pulling my words out of those, because those are the exact words that I teach about when I, as I said before, when I was in the traditional classroom. I'm not in that setting anymore. I now teach teachers and parents and organizations all about what I understand about behaviors, which I know. And by the way, I haven't really introduced you other than who you are. So would you mind telling the audience who you are, kind of what you do, and what your specialty is?
Well, my specialty is in helping people to build stronger relationships. I'm an international profiling and communication specialist, and I'm the creator of the Rapid Trait Profiling System, which just recently has been recognized by all the different empirically proven sciences that it is a science in itself. There's only one other profiling system on the planet which is a scientific-based package, and that is the one that the psychologists and all those forensic counselors, et cetera, use, which is called the Big Five. So the Big Five and Rapid Trait Profiling are the only two scientifically-based profiles out there. It looks at somebody and we see them dynamic in the moment. We can look at somebody. So I'm looking at your face. Your facial features give away your personality. I know how you like to think and process. I know how you like to be treated. And if I treat you in that particular way, the end result is you and I are going to connect very well. We're going to be able to build a strong relationship. And if you were working for me, I'd put you in the right position so that you'd be happy in what you're doing. If you're happy in what you're doing, you're more productive. But my focus has been in helping people to build relationships for, oh, God, what's it now? The first 50 years of my life, it was trying to create relationships for myself. And after two divorces and a lot of broken relationships, I realized I wasn't doing things the right way. And once I started focusing for the last 2.5 decades, helping people to be able to build their relationships and focusing on them, my relationships have improved as well. And because of the dealing with people and realizing what they were going through, I also created a group called the Campfire Project, which is a safe place for men and women from all over the world to be able to come together and share their stories that they've never had the courage to share, even with their family, their counsellors, their psychologists, or anybody like that. And they're able to open up and be treated. So I hold their space so that they know that a human being has heard what they've said, or what they're feeling, has been able to see them. And they get a great feeling out of that. And that group now has also been recognised as the gold standard for a group that's inclusive. It's leading the world on that.
That's fantastic.
Well, we've had, it's just had our 7th anniversary. It's open to all gender identities, religions, cultures. Everybody gets treated the same in there. And because of that, we've never had any bigotry, sexism, or racism. And not once in those 7 years and almost 700 hours of conversations have we ever had anybody disrespectful to anybody else.
Wow.
And that's something I'm really.
Can you teach the entire world to do that?
Well, the beautiful part of it is I don't have to teach anyone. The people who are coming in, they have to answer two questions to get into the group. And the two questions are pretty much the same question but rephrased. And that is, will you respect everyone? And when people said to me, why did you ask the same question twice? I went, there's your two chances. You don't get a third. So people knew zero tolerance to any abuse or any disrespect. And everybody realized, my God, that means if I answer those questions to come into the group, I'm safe as well. And so they recognized this was for their safety that they answer those, not just everybody else's. And the respect that the men and women have got for each other. And by the way, we have one-on-one conversations where they tell their stories. We have panel discussions where they talk about whatever issues that they want to talk about. We might have four people on screen, or we've even had six on screen. We've talked about masculinity, femininity. We've talked about drugs, alcohol. When the women that came into the group, because they had women in the group from day one, so the men could actually speak, the women could listen to how had they talked, and then I waited for the women because I knew the women would then like to step in and also join us. So we've had, as I said, close to 700 hours of conversations. We've talked about menstruation, menopause, does size matter in the bedroom? Any conversation that somebody wants to talk about, we'll talk about. And in all of that, we've never had any disrespect. And that's what I'm really proud of those people, because they came in, they wanted a safe place, and they're the ones that have made the group what it is, and they're the ones that have given it that reputation of being totally inclusive.
That's incredible, and kudos to you for pulling that together and just making that space, like I said, for everyone. And if we could all be taught that, to just understand that I may think differently than you, but that doesn't mean that I'm right and you're wrong, or that you're right and I'm wrong. It's just our experiences to that point have given us these two different perspectives. And hopefully, and I presume that the people that are joining this group are open to hearing and listening. I always say that we hear with our ears, but we listen with our heart. Mm. And it sounds like that's what your group is doing.
And that's it. It's all about listening to understand, not listening to respond. See, most people, when we're having conversations, there's two conversations going on in our own head. I say that quite often when we're in conversations, we're all schizophrenic. We've got one moment we're thinking about what we're going to say while the other person's talking, and then when we talk, we're thinking about what we're saying then. So we're planning it while they're talking and then speaking it and thinking about it when we're talking. So the end result is we're not listening to the other person. But if you, when I have these conversations with somebody, when I first started, I'd introduce them. We'd record it like this. We'd be sitting side by side on screen. We'd record it, and I'd just do an introduction of who they were. My first question was, well, tell us who you are. Tell us, you know, this is where you are today. Where did it all start for you? And they can start and tell as much or as little as they want to. And at that point, I don't need to say any more, because as they start to talk, I can see their unconscious mind is finally talking to their conscious mind and they're listening. I'm not going to interrupt that, because they're now getting the best therapy they can in the world, and that's coming from them. And after an hour or so, they walk away from that and they say, oh, that's the best therapy I've ever had. And I said, well, if you want to thank the therapist, get off the call, go look in the mirror and say thank you to yourself, because you finally started listening. Your unconscious mind's been screaming all this time. That's why you've had all these illnesses and all this stress and anxiety. But now you've realized that listening to yourself, everything's changed for you. And those people, you know, come in, love that. And then what I love the most is when men and women are on screen together talking to each other, total respect. But I've also caught them talking about each other when the other one's not there, and it's been with total respect. The way talk face to face is the same when their person's not there. That's the part I love about this, because people just really, their hearts come out. They really want to be able to connect with people. They find that finally, I thought I was on my own with the problems I've had, because everybody's got problems or all had issues. As a profiler, I know that everybody has suffered or insecure in some way. Everybody wears a mask. Everybody pretends they're not wearing a mask. And at the same time, we're also a combination of all those, they say, our childhood rewards and sufferings. In fact, we are the results of how we've decided and chosen to respond to all the events in our life. And because of that, as far as I'm concerned, everybody on the planet is on the mental health scale. It just depends on which end of the line we're on today.
Yeah.
And so once we understand that, we know that it takes away the angst or the stigma around mental health. Because when I look at a lot of neurodiverse and everything else, and I can see the gifts they've got, and I can see the potential of where they can go to. You remove the barriers and stop trying to control them or trying to turn them into something, what they achieve is mind-blowing.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for explaining what you do and all the examples that we just talked about. One thing I would like for you to define a little bit more would be profiling, because I'm sure by now the audience has picked up that your accent is not American. And so he is in the future. He's like, what did we figure out? 14 or 15 hours ahead of me. When we hear the word profile in the United States, it's in a negative way.
Mm.
So would you explain a little bit about what that word means to you and what you do?
Well, what it is being able to understand that person's personality, understanding, because I'm not interested in someone's character until I understand how they like to think and process. What's their personality? How their mind works. And so by looking at someone's face, your facial features tell me that. We have two sets of sides of our personality. We have our nature and we have our nurture. The nature of the traits that we're born with that were passed down from our parents. The nurture traits are the ones that we develop in response to our environment. And so at the same time, everything we feel inside, we express outwardly. Our brain controls the muscle movements on our face. So the end result is that when you're thinking and processing, you're going to pull expressions over and over that create ridges and crevices on the face, which are the nurture traits, the ones that we develop over time. If I can see the traits that you have, I can then know whether, well, what sort of a life you've been through? How tough has it been? You know, what's the best way for me to talk to you? How much information do you need? You know, I know that you like the overview first of all, so I'm not going to bombard you with a lot of information. And I know that once you've made your decision, you just want the best way to do it, get the hell out of the way and let me get it done. So I know that I'm not going to give you all these possible options and go into all the options. I'm going to say, well, these are a few of the options, but I won't describe them at any length. But I'll say out of those, this is the best one. This is why this one's the best one, so that you won't then understand that. So it's all about how do I communicate with you in a way that you want to be communicated with without wasting your time. Because if I knew, had a lot of information to tell you, I'd say, look, Shelley, there's a lot of information here, and you'd go, oh, God, no, you know, this is going to be a lecture. And I go, no, well, what I'm going to do is give you the overview, and then you ask all the questions that you want to ask. But if there's something there that you haven't asked that I think you need to know, then it's all right if I tell you that then. So now you know we're going to have a conversation. I'm not going to be talking at you. So this is why we do this, to build relationships. You know, I know that because of all the TV shows, you know, Lie to Me and all those things, that profiling was always trying to catch criminals and people get worried. People used to ask me, you know, what's your 15-second elevator speech? And I used to say, well, when people would say, what do you do? I said, I clear rooms. And they say, what, you clean rooms? No, I clear rooms. They look at me and they go, what are you talking about? And I said, well, look, when people find out what I do, they all run out of the room. But when they find out why and how I do it, they come back and they bring their family and friends and colleagues. Because it's about how do I make a connection with you to help you to be the best version of yourself, to be happy in what you're doing. Every boss needs to know that, because if the people are happy, they're going to be more productive and they're going to make more money. At the same time, if they want to work on their business, they have to be able to have the right people working in the business so they can go away and promote their business themselves. And in fact, if they do it well enough, they can not only go away and promote their business, they can go on holidays and will not only survive in their absence, it will grow. And that's only when you've got the right people in there. And the only way you get the right people is treat them the right way. This is all about building relationships, not pigeonholing people and putting them in a position where they feel that they're being put down and controlled. This is about how to help somebody develop and grow and flourish.
Become that butterfly.
That's it.
So what do you say to people that they think they want to do a certain style of job or do it a certain way, but that's not really the best for them? I feel like there are so many people that are in jobs, and I say that kind of negative, like it's a job, it's a way to a paycheck. It's just, you know, I'm not happy here. I just go here every day and, you know, do what these people ask me to do. I don't enjoy it, but I get it done. And then there are people that they go to an occupation, or they go to, you know, they don't even call it work because they have found what it is that fires them up every day. So what do you say to those people who are in that job where it's just, I have to go here every day and I don't like it, but I think this is what I'm good at?
Yeah, well, what you'll find is that they're doing a job that never really suited their personality. So a job that suits our personality, we're doing things we love to do and we're going to be productive, we're going to be happy. But how many people see, well, let's go back to school to start with. At school, we worked on our weaknesses. I was kept back after school because I was not that crash hot in English and a few other subjects, and they got me up to a higher level. I hated school. But the things that I loved to do, I got better results in. And so I looked at it and thought, rightio, what do I want out of my life? I want to be happy. I want to be doing things that I love doing. So, well, as far as the traits go, in a newborn child, we can see traits and we understand what they're going to be like, what sort of school they should go to, what's going to fit their personality. We know the hobbies and sports that will suit them. As they're going through school and we understand their personalities and more of their nurture traits are starting to develop, we know what sort of careers will suit them. Now, depending on their academic levels, some of the kids will go, okay, this is the sort of work I'd like to do. Is there a role where I go to university for that, or if I go to TAFE, or do I just go out into the workforce? But if we can understand their personality traits, we can always make sure that whatever career they go into, it's something they're going to enjoy doing. Now, if they enjoy doing it, they're not going to need as much money. If you're somebody who is goes into a job you don't like and you're miserable, that's going to affect your health. So you're going to need to make more money to be able to pay your medical bills. And so the happier you are, the more productive you are, and the healthier you are as well, because everything stems from within. So if we if we're worried about certain issues all the time, that's going to eat away at us. And we start getting physical problems as well. The physical and the emotional are connected. The neurology and the physiology are connected. And once you start to understand that, we realize, right, if I can go into a career that I love doing and I'm enjoying myself, then I'm going to be happier. If I'm happier at work, then I'm going to be happier at home. So I know then things like fighting with your spouse, fighting with the children is going to be reduced because you go home happier. The organization knows that they're going to make more money because if you're happy, you're more productive. We know that if somebody has been bullied at work, their performance drops by 70%. If they haven't been bullied, but they observe bullying in the workplace, theirs will drop by about 40%. So the company is losing money when their people aren't happy. So the person who owns that company, if they really want to be profitable, their focus is on their people. Make sure their people are happy because they're the ones who look after the clients. Excuse me. It will then mean that they will make more money because the customers will stay with them. This is the whole thing. I realized a long time ago, if I help other people get what they want, I will always get what I want. And so, and as they say, if you open a bank account up, you have to put money into it before you can take money out.
That is true. That is very true. And I think a lot of people don't really think about that. And they just go about life and just think, this is all there is. This is all, you know, either this is the only job that was available to me, or this is, you know, this is all that I can do, or this is all that I'm good at. I know there's all these personality tests and I guess that's the right word to describe them.
Yeah.
How do you feel about those compared to what you do?
Well, I used to work with Myers-Briggs, DISC, Enneagrams, and a few other programs back in the 80s. That's where I started with them. Where everything changed for me was, funny enough, after my second divorce. So in the 70s, I started with body language. In the 80s, psychometric profiling. In the 90s, I got my NLP masters, et cetera. In the early 2000s, there was a company that taught currency trading. They asked me to come in because none of their students were making money, even though they had one of the best instructors. He was a fantastic instructor, and he was a very qualified and successful trader as well. But they still weren't making money. So I put people through Myers-Briggs and DISC profiling sessions. When they went live, they weren't matching their personality. So the problem with those, whenever you answer questions, there's self-reporting. You will always answer it in a way in which you're thinking, well, how are people going to see me? So I get enough of that as well. People, when they find out what I do, straight away are worried about what I'm seeing. And so this is why they, if they answer the questions themselves, they're going to try and second guess that. And if they do a questionnaire right now in this particular role, in another part of their life. So at work, they may come into somebody who's very controlling and very demanding, et cetera. So put him in a leadership role. At home, they're subservient. And what actually, we know that somebody who's been bullied will bully others to feel better. So if they might be operating that way at work because of the way they're treated at home. They're static. It's in that situation. When you're looking at someone's face, and I look at you and I go, right, tell me a situation. Okay, I know how you'll operate in that. Okay, here's another situation. I can see how you'll operate in that straight away. It's dynamic. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things, is, you know, and at the same time, using the other systems, if I'm emotional and I'm reading you, then I'm going to make judgments based on that. So it's going to be judgmental. It's not going to be a judgment. Whereas if I'm looking at facial features, et cetera, doesn't matter if I'm happy or sad, my emotions have nothing to do with it. And your emotions have nothing to come back and impact on me because I'm not asking you questions. I've already got your personality from your facial features. I've got that from your photograph. And how powerful this is. I've got a business coach in Perth. He sent me 5 photographs the way I wanted them taken. I sent him a 45-minute audio back talking about what I could see in his traits, how they work together, because one trait doesn't define you. It's a combination of traits. But I explained each trait, and then I explained how they work together in different situations in coaching, how he could use that to his benefit and how people saw him. That was when he told me before he took on that role, in his previous career, he was an undercover narcotics agent for 2 decades. He'd used skills that he believed were up to 95% accurate. As he said, if they hadn't been, he wouldn't be alive today. But the end result was what I put in that audio, as he said, not only matched but nuanced everything he learned about himself in those 2 decades.
Wow.
That's the power of this. And at that point, of course, he then went, okay, what's the next step? Can I do the master course? Mm-hmm. Because he realized that this helped him to understand himself. He understood how other people saw him. Because when we look at ourselves, we go, we're the center of the world, of our world. Everybody else is either left or right of us. But what we need to know is, where do they see us on that world scale? So if I had somebody in the room that had 100 people and they just do talked about that person, they'll all give you a different result on what they think of that person. They go through my training, and next thing you know, we profile one person, 100 people will come up with the same profile because they see where that person is on the world scale. And they all then know how much they need to change the way they like to be spoken to match the way the other person needs to be spoken to. So the facial features give you that foundation. That's the most solid part of the whole process. This is what gives it a power over even FBI profilers who are all looking at the behavior. This gives you the foundation to go, okay, this is how they do think and process. But then I've got the feedback from their body language and their emotions, the expressions on their face that will give me the feedback. So first of all, you've got the facial features that tell you the person's personality. Then you know how to change the words to speak to them. But then you go, okay, how do I deliver those words? So the paralanguage comes in. And then we've got, you know, the breathing, the way, the tone and all the rest of it. Then we've got the feedback from the body language and the micro expressions, little twitches on the face. There's tellers, did we read them right? Is there something emotionally going on? And are they telling the truth? But I don't use that last part as a lie detector. I use it as a truth seeker. Because if someone's not telling me the truth, what is the reason for it? Is it they feel, you know, they've been through a tough life and everything else and they're worried about what other people think of them? Well, what I do, if I can connect with them, they'll find out what I think about them and it'll be much higher than what they think about themselves. They always walk away feeling that they've been respected, they've been understood. In a lot of cases, people have said to me, nobody ever understood me in that way before.
Mm-hmm.
They felt naked that I could actually see them at that level, but they felt really happy because they were looking a lot better than what they thought of themselves in the first place.
Right.
So that's
that is incredible.
It's not just the profiling. This is the thing, the words we use. If I said, you know, I've got a couple in front of me and they both say that in their relationship, loyalty is the most important thing.
Mm-hmm.
You ask one of them what loyalty means to them, I guarantee it'll be different to what the other one says. This is the problem. We get caught up on the words instead of going, okay, the person's this, well, what does that mean?
Right. Yes. Again, I feel like you have been in my head And in my presentations and, you know, like everything that I have put out on social media and conversations that I've had, because so much of what you're saying a little bit differently, you know, like you said, the words, you're using the words a little bit different, but the concept is the same. And I tell people this, here in the United States, I do a lot of reading over, they're called individual education programs, which is the document that drives our special education. And so often kids will have behavioral goals of being respectful. And I ask them, what does that mean? Well, it means to be kind. What does that mean? Because it was exactly what I believe exactly what you just said, that we use words and we have our own picture of what that looks like in our head, and somebody else's isn't the same way. And it's not, again, like I kind of mentioned at the beginning, that one way is right and one way is wrong. But when we're taking data for these IEP documents on whether or not a student is being respectful, everybody should be basing that on the same definition. So if you want whatever your team decides is the definition of respectful, that needs to be written into the document, because otherwise kids aren't reaching their goals, or they're losing, you know, points or tokens on their daily behavioral sheets because one teacher's definition of respect and another teacher's definition of respect is different. So they're not looking at it the same way. I hate to say judgment, but they're not judging it the same way.
See, I've worked with kids who have called me by my first name, who have joked with me and everything else, and people have said, you know, they're not respectful. I go, yes, they are, because this is the way I like to connect with them, because I know if I'm talking their language and treating them in the way that they want to be treated, they'll respond with that. So I know I'm respecting them. So what I'm getting in return is respect, but it's the way I interpret what I look for respect, because at the end of the day, I don't have to be right, but I have to know that the other person is all right. That was important to me.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And I raised three boys on my own. Yeah, when my first wife left, I had three sons to raise on my own. They're 4, 11, and 12. And I know that when they get upset about different things, and, you know, they're all in their, one's in his 30s and the other two are in their 40s already. And so when we have those conversations, we talk about things, and they've said, well, yeah, you don't get upset. And I go, no, my job is not to be right. My job is to make sure you're all right. That's my responsibility as your father. And by the way, I told them when they were very young, I'm never going to be your friend, because your friends will tell you when you're doing the wrong thing, it's okay. I'm your father. I'll be telling you when it's wrong. And so I'll take on that role. But my whole life is going to be put to, you know, because my responsibility as a parent is to make sure that you're all right and that you become the best version of you. And so with that, the boys knew exactly. It wasn't about putting titles on them or seeing them get to certain levels of work. Because one of my oldest boy had said to me one day, you must be more proud of my cousin than you are of me. And I said, why? Because they're about 15 days apart. Matthew's a year older, 15 days older, I should say, than Luke. And as we were talking, I said, well, no. I said, the way he talks to people, he doesn't have that much respect. But you treat everybody the same. You treat people with respect. I'm more proud of you. I said, I don't care, because he's got his own business. He's, you know, in security and he's making a lot of money. And my son at that time had worked with a number of companies, but each time a company went into, they were heading towards liquidation. So he was in jobs and out of jobs, in jobs. And he said, I can't find the right place. I said, look, mate, I don't care if you're sweeping streets. I know that your streets are going to be swept cleaner than everybody else's. I know the way you treat everybody, from the boss right down to the person who's right at the, you know, lowest level, is going to be with respect. And that's what I'm proud of. So I'm more proud of you than I am of your cousin. This is the thing that I think is so important, that people realize that if you can find their strengths and show them where their strengths are, they're going to be happier. If they're happier, they're going to be more productive. There's less arguments and anger and everything else.
Yes.
And you'll get a lot of respect back.
And it, just what you said, I mean, I'm just going to sit here because I don't really want to add anything else, because what you're saying is again, so much of how I believe and how I think I treat everybody. I try to treat everybody with respect. I'm sure I've not been 100% successful because I am human. I am going to make mistakes occasionally, probably more than occasionally. And in the 54 years that I've been on the planet, I'm sure I've made more than an occasional mistake. But I also think that grace is involved and is important because yes, the respect, you know, and again, what you determine is respectful. If you are working with someone, if it's a parent-child relationship, if it's a husband-wife relationship, if it's whatever relationship, you need to determine what respect is for each other and try to be, you know, fulfilling that person's definition of respect. And you know, there's a lot of things I believe are taken for granted when they should be talked about. And I think that's kind of one of them. Like, you know, everybody grows up in a different household. Even if you're siblings, even if you're twins, you grow up in a different household. Because what we mentioned before, you know, your perspective is different. What your nature is and what your nurture is, you know, how you're seeing things. And so understanding like, yeah, that wasn't respectful and here's the reason why, or that's not how I want you to, you know, do that particular task and here's the reason why, and explain it all and talk about it all. But we just don't do that.
That's
why,
right.
Who knows? Lots of different reasons.
Yeah. Well, when we talk to somebody, we usually talk in the way that we want to be spoken to ourselves. You know, the amount of information, the order and all the rest of the formality or informality of it. Once we realize that the other person is different to us, this is why we're not connecting. So if I know how the other person likes to think and process, I speak in their particular way. We become each other's environments, and the environment always impacts on a person. So if I want to see a change in somebody else, I make a change in me first, and I present that new version of me to them. If I walk up to somebody with a smile on my face, I'm more than likely going to get a smile back. If I go up with a scowl and an angry look, I'm going to get a completely different response. If I understand that and I realize that, okay, if I can learn how to connect with that other person far more effectively, I know that the response we're going to have is going to be so much better. And it's not a matter of changing them. It's changing us. And this is where I love working with parents, especially those that have children who are neurodiverse. Now, autism, Asperger's, whatever that might be, that the parent understands and knows how to talk to the child. Because once you talk to the child in the way in which they need to be spoken to, the child feels more understood. They're less likely to get triggered. In a lot of cases, they need less medication. If they get less medication, they flourish better and faster, because all we're doing is diagnosing these kids and putting them into boxes to fit the system instead of what do we need to do to change the system. I've got one mother who just the other weekend reminded me it's been 15 years since I profiled her son and she's still doing testimonials for me. Now,
wow.
He has Asperger. He was 6 years old at the time. The school didn't want him. The after-school care didn't want him. They were trying to force her to heavily medicate him so he'd fit into the system. The psychologist said he'd need a carer for the rest of his life. And so I got her, I said, look, will he sit still for me? And she said, no. I said, right, I want you to take 5 photographs. This is how I want them taken and send them to me. When I got them, he was wearing different outfits in a couple of the shots. So even she couldn't get him to sit still long enough. Right. So I profiled him. I gave her a written report that she took back to the school and the after-school care with some suggestions that I suggested. She played one against the other, telling each of them the others were doing it. And if they didn't do it, it would fail to be on their heads. Nobody wanted to be responsible. Within a year, he was doing presentations in front of the class. Within the next year, they let the psychologist go because they didn't need him anymore. And with the doctor's approval, medication was off the table. And because of that, he flourished, and the conversation he was having with his mother all the time were more mature and more connected. She actually said to me, you've given me my son back. And so when he was 2 years ago, when he was 19, he'd moved from, this is a boy that they said would always need a carer for the rest of his life. Mm-hmm. He'd moved from New South Wales to the next state up, which is Queensland, living on his own, got his own place, driving a car, got a girlfriend, and he was heading towards becoming an assistant manager in a nightclub where he was working.
Wow. That is a beautiful example of no limits right there.
That's exactly right. So I put this, I put a reminder of that out the other day, and so it was she's been doing testimonials for me for 13 years. Next thing you know, I got a phone call from her saying, Alan, you can't tell Thomas. What are you talking about? I said, did I get it wrong? She said, yes, you did. He's now 21 and he is the assistant manager in the nightclub.
Oh, my gosh.
This is the thing. If we can recognize their abilities. I profiled children there in America for their school teachers and for the parents. Parents have got to be involved, of course. And I teach each party how they like to be spoken to change that to speak to the child the same way. So the parents, husband and wife, will be different to each other themselves. So while they're learning how to talk to their child, they're also learning the differences that they have, and they learn to talk to each other better as well. So everybody gets an advantage there. At the same time, if the teacher knows that, they can then support the parents and support the child. I had one boy in America who the teacher had said he was seeing the school principal every other day. He was in the after-school care that she looked after. And talked to the parents, and they said, well, he's always misbehaving, having a hell of a time at home. And I said, well, send me the photographs. This is the way I want them taken. I sent back an audio saying this is how you handle it all. Next thing you know, I got a call from the school, the teacher, saying that his behavior had changed completely in the classroom. The father sent me a testimonial saying that his behavior at home had improved. This was when he was in elementary school. Then he went to, I think it's middle school is the next one over there in the States. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And he was now playing baseball or whatever it was. At the same time, his academic levels had gone up and he was being a better kid at home again. So all the problems had disappeared, all because it wasn't trying to get him to do something different. They changed and therefore that guided him. This is what people don't realize. If I can get this person to change, it's go, no, change the way you're talking to them, change the way you're connecting with them, and I guarantee they will change because their environment's changed. It has to. They have to act differently because they're not. If I'm scowling all the time, they're not going to be smiling. But if I'm smiling all the time, then they will be smiling.
Yes,
it's so simple.
Oh my gosh, yeah. I'm sitting here and this is like heaven talking to you because you are just confirming everything that I have taught for the last 5 or 6 years outside of the classroom. But what I did. Or tried to do, again, wasn't perfect at it, but what I tried to do in the classroom, and it's just, this could very easily be a, multiple hour conversation that I have with you. And so I'm trying to be very cognizant of the amount of time that we're on here. So we're still doing really well as far as time goes, but it's so amazing to me to hear someone on the literal other side of the world who is seeing these same things and is reaching people and not just that one student. I mean, you told me before we came on air that, you have helped hundreds, dozens. I don't remember the exact number, but I knew, it's a high number of students be able to understand where they were told, oh, they're, they don't understand verbal cues. They are nonverbal cues. They don't understand facial expressions. They don't understand tone of voice. And I was just recently telling a student, 93% of our communication is nonverbal. It's the tone. It's the cadence. It's the what our body language is doing. What I didn't tell him about the micro expressions, but it's what our face says. And then I run through exercises with students in like tutoring sessions, but then also with teachers. And I have them read the same sentence six or seven times, and one word is highlighted. And when they get, when it's their turn to read, I say, when you read that highlighted word, put emphasis on that word. And how that changes the context of what's being said. And people don't understand that. And it's kind of baffling to me because that was an exercise I did in college back in the 1900s. So I'm like, if I did it in the 1900s, what happened to it? Where did it go? Why are we not teaching people this anymore?
And that's one of the biggest issues. But first of all, I'd like to really commend you on running this, the group and the podcast and everything else. You're giving the opportunity for more people because the world's full of people like us. but we don't know about each other because we haven't had that medium to connect. So podcasts like this are so important. It allows us to meet and realize there are other people around the world that are same. Excuse me. When COVID first hit, I went on to a thing called Lunch Club, which was part of with some people who were in LinkedIn. And they would, you know, you'd tell what sort of people you wanted to meet, and they would match you up. And I'd be talking to people all over the world. And I did that for two reasons. One, I wanted to find out about different cultures, but I also wanted to find out how people were responding to COVID at the time. And in those conversations, I found so many similarities that we had. And once I've got similarities, I've got understanding of that person. Once I've got that, then I can look at the differences and go and understand why they do the things they do. It doesn't mean I condone what they've done, but I can have that conversation with them. You know, over the years, I've spoken to people who had been hitmen, who have been involved in all different areas, and I've been able to sit there and have conversations with them and understand why they did what. Definitely didn't condone them, but understood what their pathway, what were the things that, you know, nudged them to go down different pathways. Because I look at my own life, as I said, divorced twice, a lot of broken relationships, business partners who emptied the bank out. I've worked in just about every industry you can think of. I've been a surf lifesaver as well, and all these things, all these little things came up and pushed me down different paths. But I've realized all the way through, and everything I've done in life, it's always been around connections with people, understanding relationships, desire to be able to create relationships, and now helping other people to create relationships. But understanding that what drives us is our desires of what we want to do, but where we have issues is when our personalities clash. I knew in sales they talked about an 80-20% rule, and they break the 20% into two tens. The first 10, even Eskimos will buy ice off you. They'll buy snow off you, and that because it's just that connection in the personalities. At the far end, they wouldn't buy a fire extinguisher off you if they were on fire, because the personalities are so different. And in between, there's a sliding scale. And in sales, you're looking at how far you can get into that 80% towards the other. This is how you build your business. But it shows us there are so many people that are so different, but we have that lack of communication. Couples, for instance, we get together because something in the personalities excited us. So both you and I have aesthetic appreciation. It's how things feel inside. When we're stressed, we pull back to our cave. But if we have somebody who's got the dramatic appreciation, they like to express outwardly. They're the life of the party. They're the ones that get up on stage and everything else, and they're exciting to be around. But once we get used to that excitement and that side of their traits, now we notice the downside. When they do stress, it's repeated and it keeps coming out. It's too much for us. When we get stressed, we pull off to our cave. The rest of the time, when we're happy, we seem to be laid back, and they find that comfortable to be around. So they next thing you know, your partner has said, you've changed. No, their perception of you has changed. You haven't. Right. And once you understand that, when I've got couples, I'll say to one who's got the aesthetic appreciation, you find that your partner gets all excited and everything else when they're stressed, and that's too much energy. They go, yes. And I go, right. Well, you've got an easy way of answering this. You just ask them, is this something you want me to fix, or do you want me to listen? If they ask you to fix it, one of two things. It's something that's come up that they know that you can fix, or you screwed up in the first place and they just want you to fix that. If they just want you to listen, they've already told you it's got nothing to do with you. Do you care about your partner? Yes, I do. Okay, hold their space. Just be there for them, because once they get it out, it's gone. In your case, they would say to their partner, if you know, your partner's gone quiet and you're worried about what's going on, then just ask them, is it anything to do with me? No, it's not. Is it anything I can do to help? No, it's not. Okay, I know you need to work on this on your own, so I'm going to leave you alone to do that. But so your partner then knows you haven't just given up. You know, when you get it to a point where you come back and talk about it, can you come back and explain it, because I care. So both partners now that they got, one knows they got the support of the other when they need to vent. The other one knows that the other partner will give them space when they need to work on a problem themselves. That brings them back together. Next thing you know, they spice back in the relationship. This is marriage counseling 101 and done in 5 minutes.
Right.
You go to therapy for week after week and that, looking at all the problems you had in the past and dwelling more on that. You just go straight back to the thing that attracted you in the first place, and bang, you got that relationship back again.
Yeah.
So this is quite funny. When I'm helping parents with their children, they say, oh, we've got problems with our kid. And I go, okay, we'll do that. I know looking at them, there's going to be a big change in the way they treat each other. And when they're happier, that impacts on the child as well.
Yes. Yep, absolutely. And I think, I think parents don't realize how much of how they treat one another, how they treat the child, what they say about the child to each other affects the child.
Yeah. Well, if you're putting down your ex-partner, for instance, then the end result is you're telling your children half of them is no good because their DNA came from both parties, both parents.
Right.
Now, at that point, you may feel that you're winning because your kids, you're alienating your kids from your ex-partner. But the end result is over time, those kids will resent you. You will lose their respect completely. It's a slow way to damage your own relationship with the kids. To have anger for somebody else is like taking poison and hoping they will die. It doesn't happen. You're the one who's going to get the effect of it. And this is the thing. I realized that when my first wife left and I had the three boys to raise on my own, I knew that I had to get her to have more involvement with the boys for two reasons. One, that they would then be able to, they respected their mother, they would respect women in their lives. And at the same time, I knew that if I was bagging her, that would affect my relationship with them. The end result, I remember when the oldest boy was 18 years old, he was at the door heading off to school. He stopped, turned around, he said, I just wanted to let you know, I've been talking to my brothers and we think we're lucky to have you. And I went, what? I said, you know, your mother and I are separated. And he said, yeah, but I can go to her place and we're here. There's no arguments. Neither of you are whinging about the other one. We've got two houses that we're happy to go to. I said, well, what about all your mates? They're all got parents at home. And he said, well, you haven't noticed that after school there's 15 kids here because they don't want to go home because parents are always arguing. Right. And that's when I realized that. And first of all, my first wife didn't have much to do with the boys at first, but I made sure that she spent some more time with them. And I knew that they needed that connection to be able to grow and mature. And that was quite important. So when she came to me one day, she said, well, when I got married the second time, my youngest boy moved out and lived back with her, and he was about 16 at the time. I'd take him out camping and he'd go back respectful for a week or two, and then he'd start fighting with her again. I'd take him out bush and we're going through the cycle. And she said, well, look, what can you do about this? And I said, well, my job will be to help him. I'll help make sure that you get their respect. But once you get that respect, your job is to keep it because I'm not coming back and trying to recover that again. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing was if he didn't respect his mother, then that was going to be a problem. But his older brothers who are now living out on their own, they were watching this as well. But their mates were also watching everything that was going on. So not only did it impact on my sons, it impacted on all their friends. And that was why there was always 15 kids in my house, you know, after school. And because of that, so I realized at that point you have to put the others first. And when you're putting the others first, you're also putting yourself – if I lift people up, then I'm also lifting me up at the same time. I've never put anybody on a pedestal. I've always lifted myself at the same time because if I see something good in them, that must be in me as well. This is what people don't realize. They look at someone and think, oh, I wish I could be like them. Well, if you wish you could be like them, I guarantee you have that in you as well. You just need to recognize it.
That's good. Yeah, absolutely. Well, we do only have a few minutes left, and I do want to make sure that everybody knows how to get a hold of you. So I have put several links into the chat, both on Facebook and YouTube. So wherever you're watching this, and if you're listening on just the podcast, these links will be in the show notes, or, you know, you can come back to the YouTube channel and find some of these notes. And then the main one that he said you told me to put up earlier was your LinkedIn one. So I am going to put that up on the screen, and it's the linkedin.com/in/readingfaces. And once you get there, you'll get lots of other information and all the other he's on. I mean, I used to think I was on a lot of social media until I got your list. And I mean, I'm not on hardly anything compared to that list. But I did try to put several of those, as I said, into the chat section. And then also I want to put up your website, which is just www.alanstevens.com.au. You've again probably picked up on his accent. He is from Australia, and he's also mentioned it a few times where, you know, the Queensland. And so Alan is A-L-A-N-S-T-E-V-E-N-S. So again, just check the comments, check the show notes from the podcast and go find him. I mean, for my audience, they probably feel as though I prepped you tremendously to say all the things that you said, because if anybody's followed me for a while, they've heard a lot of what you've said differently, but you know, the concept, like I said, is the same. So before we wrap up, I just want to give you one last opportunity. If there was something that you really wanted to say or talk about, that we get that in these last couple of minutes.
Not a problem. Very first, on the website, when I went through the www, if that doesn't work, take that out. So HTTPS, okay, et cetera. Uh-huh. But things I always like to point out to people, one of your coaches over there in UCLA, what's his name, John Wooden, had said the most important thing you'll ever learn is the next thing you learn after you think you know everything. So always have an open mind and always take things in and learn from it. It was Bruce Lee who had said, listen to everybody, take things in and work out what fits you, keep that, discard what doesn't fit you, but add your own style to it as well. And I think the Arabs have a saying, trust everybody, but lock up your camels at night. So putting all that together, I always say, right, listen to everybody, take everything in, work out what works for you, but assess everything for you. Everything I've talked about today, anything you see on my website or anything else, test it for yourself. I know growing up, my mother used to always say, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. You can say how great you made it and everything else, but it's not until you put your teeth into it and taste it, you know how accurate that was. And so that's why I gave you that free course there as well for people to be able to give that. But just remember, there's another more powerful saying that I've always lived by, and that is what you do for yourself dies with you. But what you do for others is and always, and for the community, et cetera, is and always will be eternal. And that's one of the reasons why through the Campfire Project and other things that I'm doing, I've now got more friends all over the world that I'd never imagined I could have. And that was because I decided I wanted to connect with other people and understand them, putting them first, which, by the way, put me first at the same time. You can't put the others first without putting yourself first.
I love that. So I did. I do want to put up that it's store.alanstevens.com.au/free. That is that item that he just mentioned as far as in his closing. So, Alan, thank you. I could literally, as I said, have a multi-hour conversation with you, but we're not going to put my listeners through that because I think you and I could get really deep and down into some really grainy things and we could tell stories.
Well, as you
and
saw all of that, that sort of I can stuff. Talk. I can talk underwater.
When it comes to behaviors, I think I can too. And probably other people would say, yeah, she never shuts up about behaviors. But thank you so much again for being my guest today. It has been a true pleasure and an honor for you to be here. And so guys, just make sure that you have liked, subscribed, and that you have set that notification bell to on, because you don't want to miss any episodes from this point forward if you haven't already done those things. Today was a tremendous episode, and all of my episodes have amazing qualities. They don't all talk about exactly the same thing other than we know who we are, but not who we will be, and to bust through those limits. Have a great week. I will see you next time. Bye-bye.
Hey, parents and teachers, are you tired of IEP meetings that feel like a battle? Let's put an end to the tension and create a collaborative, calm, and respectful environment together. Shelly Kino, your go-to IEP consultant, can transform your meetings into positive and productive experiences. With Shelly Kino, your child is her top priority, your voice is heard, and you become confident. Shelly Kino is making the world better for all, one IEP at a time. Visit www.shellykino.com for more information and set up your free 20-minute consultation today. That's shellykino.com, S-H-E-L-L-E-Y-K-E-N-O-W.